Well, we come to the end of our trivia quiz, and Don, you've done so well here. We want to open it up to the audience. We have a microphone here. We would love to have you go to the microphone with your questions for Don Gagne to conclude our politics and pine. It's been such a wonderful evening. And if you'd say your first name and where you're from, and tilt the microphone up if you need to. Sir, your name is?
Tim from Ames.
Tim from Ames, welcome to our event here. And what is your question for Don Gagne?
Yes, do you think the Tea Party will warm to Chris Christie?
I don't usually make predictions, but I just don't see that happening.
So you got no. So what happens to make it a no? Play out a narrative there that you could see happening, denying him the Tea Party support.
Obviously, he's a governor of a big blue state. He is suspect on issues from, from taxes to how he's handled same-sex marriage to, though that's more of a concern among evangelicals than Tea Partiers, though obviously there's some overlap there. And he is perceived as a guy who wants to get things done, and if he needs to make a deal to get something done, he'll make the deal to get something done, and then he'll try to come back for the rest later. And we can go back to our earlier discussion of John Boehner to see what the Tea Party thinks of that. So, the whole question then is Christie versus who, and where else do they go? I mean, I think ultimately on Election Day in 2012, Romney did not do that poorly with Tea Party voters, because the alternative was Barack Obama, and we know what the Tea Party thinks of President Obama. That said, it's hard to see them being a constituency that Christie is able to win over, especially in what's important here is during the primaries, obviously. So, yeah.
Don Gagne is with us. If you just joined us, NPR national political correspondent, a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, Politics and a Pint. We're coming to you. This is recorded at the venue at Court Center in downtown Des Moines before a live audience. And we're going to our audience now for questions for Don Gagne. And yes, sir, your name?
Leo from Des Moines. And hearing Don talk about how he has to cover issues today made me wonder, with the way the Obama presidency is controlling the message and not working with the national press, how has that shaped your work, and also how do you see it happening in the future with covering presidencies?
It's interesting, because I covered 8 years of the Bush presidency, though in reality, for the eighth year of the Bush presidency, I was covering the election and spent that year on the Obama campaign plane. I got on the Obama plane the night he won the Iowa caucuses, and basically got off his plane election day in Chicago. Now I did get a days off and weekends, so it wasn't quite like that. But it was, if I was working, I was pretty much on his plane that entire year. And I lost my train of thought, though. I mean, what was the main point of the question?
With how the Obama presidency.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. How is it different? So anyway, one of the reasons I wanted to stay at the White House for another year or two after having done all 8 years already, when you kind of age in dog years when you cover the White House, because it's long days and a lot of travel and a lot of deadlines and this and that. But I wanted to stick around to see how the Obama administration would be different. I was also very well sourced because I'd spent the year with them, and it was pretty much the same. It was pretty much the same. Now, which is not to say that President Obama is George W. Bush. I mean, obviously, their policies are different.
But
their approach is different.
In terms of the treatment of the press and the insular nature that
yes.
the Obama presidency has become toward the press.
Yes. And has become implies that they have become that. It was like that from the beginning.
Okay.
It was like that from the beginning. But if I talk to some of my friends who are in the White House press corps, who are photographers, I mean, we're all frustrated that there's too little access and not enough interviews and not enough chances to ask questions and, you know, all of that. And no matter what they give us, we'll want more also, because that's our job, just is. But they were just as controlling and limiting of press access as the Bush White House was. And I was having this conversation with someone, a very identical conversation. The day the healthcare ruling came down from the Supreme Court, and a friend of mine who's a photographer for the Associated Press cut me off and said, this White House is way worse. And what he was saying is there are far fewer moments for photographers to take an objective news photograph of the president, either in the Oval or with a foreign leader or at an event. The White House has been very effectively, I might say, using their own Flickr feed and their own official photographer to put out pictures. And some of them are very charming photos. Like, how many people saw the picture of the little kid dressed as Spider-Man zapping Obama and having him like falling backwards? Now, the press would never expect to have that photo because it happened somewhere in the West Wing and it was a moment. So that photo's like okay, but what people forget is it was taken by a White House photographer. So this is not a journalistic moment. You don't know what preceded it. You don't know what followed it. I'm not saying it was staged. I'm not saying that at all. But you don't know that it wasn't because it was not an independent eye capturing it. But where these guys really get upset is there'll be a bill signing, there'll be a public event where the White House photographer will get a much better angle or much closer access, or they'll be trying to shoot the president from the riser, and in the middle of their shot is his own photographer, who's like 3 feet away from him, not only getting a much better shot, but blocking their shot is what. So it's so that's one area where it's clear they have taken it to a new level. But just generally speaking, any White House wants to limit and control access. And I think as Facebook and Twitter and Flickr and all of these other social media outlets become more and more prominent, they have many, many, many more outlets to get their message out, and they're happy to ignore us.
Yeah. Next question for Don Gagne from our audience here at the venue at Court Center in downtown Des Moines. Yes, sir, your name.
My name is Pat from Des Moines. Many people were surprised when a member of Congress shouted out, "You lie." Were you surprised? Was the press corps surprised? Did that ripple across the nation the way it rippled across Iowa?
It did. I don't want to say it was unprecedented, because I suspect in the kind of rough and tumble days of the, you know, of the 19th century and the like, it was very different when the president went up on Capitol Hill and there weren't television cameras recording every moment. So who knows what kind of things were said back then. But for that to happen at that moment, the president speaking before a joint session of the Congress, it rippled through the press corps as well. It was fascinating, though. It was Joe Wilson from South Carolina, Congressman Joe Wilson, who shouted it out. And the president was talking about health care at the time, I think, unless I'm sure. Mistaken. I mean, we can fact check that. But at any rate, it not only rippled through the press corps, through the rest of the country, But it made Joe Wilson a hero in his district and in his state. Obviously, South Carolina, a very conservative state. And he was voicing what a lot of people in his district felt. So, and I think it also helped him with his fundraising a great deal. So even though he was, perhaps a bit contrite, I mean, this is going back almost 5 years ago now, or four plus years now. I don't remember exactly what he had to say then, but he didn't suffer politically, and he didn't suffer in terms of his ability to raise money. So,
next question for Don Gagne from our audience. Yes, ma'am. What is your name, please?
Amanda.
Amanda, welcome, and your question.
There's clearly a very reactionary conservative portion of our populace embodied by the Tea Party. How do you see that long-term relationship working within the Republicans? Do you think that there could be a viable third party from the right appearing? Mm-hmm.
This is a really, really fascinating topic. And it's something we haven't talked about, but it's important to talk about, is the Republican Party's kind of internal battle to, A, figure out what it is and figure out a way forward in a very dynamic and changing country in terms of the demographics of the country. The Tea Party has been pushing back hard against many of the things that the leader of the Republican Party, the chairman of the Republican Party, has said the party needs to do. And he said these things after the last election, when the president won re-election, and it was a bad, bad day for Republicans, the last presidential election. And the Republican Party embarked upon this kind of soul-searching effort, appointing a committee very kind of important or credible or whatever, kind of people within the party. And they performed what Reince Priebus, the RNC chairman, called an autopsy, which was a choice of words he kind of quickly regretted. And he's only used it once, but he did say that it was kind of like an autopsy. Officially, it was called the Republican Growth and Opportunity Committee. I'm pretty sure that's the term. But they spoke not of changing policies, and they spoke not of changing their approach or their ideology, but talking about ways to be less off-putting to young people, to Latino voters, especially with their stand on immigration, the very tough stand the party has taken on immigration. And it was kind of a path forward without specific recommendations. A lot of talk about changing the tone and the way they present themselves, because they made the point they want to be a big tent party, and they are a big tent party, and they should be a big tent party. But they've had trouble making any progress on some of the key things. And if you look at the Latino population in the U.S., it's the fastest growing voter group in the country. At some point, if it happens a couple of cycles down the road or more, the growing Latino population, again, assuming Latinos continue to favor Democrats, the state of Texas could, I qualify this, but could turn blue at some point, and it's part of what's happening in North Carolina to make it a more competitive place for Democrats. So that was why we all thought that 2013 was the year that some sort of comprehensive immigration legislation would be passed. That might include a path to citizenship or whatever. And guess what? It went nowhere. Now, it'll be taken up again next year. But that's the reason it went nowhere, was because of the Tea Party. And that's kind of like just one big example of how the Tea Party creates problems for the broader party. And it's a story that's going to play out over many years. The demographic numbers do not look good for the party. Again, assuming current trends continue, and you can't necessarily assume that, but you have to make an assumption on something. The Tea Party also is falling in popularity. It's in the kind of mid-20s now or so. I got a press release from a Tea Party group last week that noted, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but noted that they're more popular than the Republican Party, which they are, and more popular than Congress. And I'm not a Nickelback fan, but I'm told Nickelback, the band, is more popular than any of them. So if you're...
Next question for NPR's Don Gagne.
Hi, I'm Clint from Ames. Just wanted to hear your thoughts on pre-Citizens United case versus post-Citizens United case here in the United States.
It's a very different world. It is a very different world. And I don't think, I'll skip ahead a little bit here by saying I don't think we've seen anything yet. I mean, the amount of money we saw in the last presidential election spent by outside groups, many of them with donors that don't report. I mean, we don't know where the money is coming from. It altered the process. I don't want to say it altered the result, because I don't think we can necessarily say that. But here's an example. There used to be this... this thing where a candidate would come to Iowa, right? And they would do well or not do well. And if they did not as well as expected, if they didn't meet expectations or exceed them, suddenly they'd have a hard time raising money, their funding would dry up, and that would be the thing that would cause them to drop out. And maybe it would be in New Hampshire, maybe it would be in South Carolina, and the field would be winnowed down. We didn't see that so much this time. Newt Gingrich, does anybody remember where he finished in Iowa? Not very high. fourth or something like that. In the old days, that would have been it. He'd have no longer been part of the equation, but he had an outside group free to spend money kind of on his behalf, and it kept him afloat. Kind of defying his own performance in actual contests. And we saw that kind of repeatedly. And it allowed people to stay in the race beyond when they would have in the past. So it changed things. It did. And then Gingrich goes on and wins South Carolina and creates real problems for Romney, and Romney has to respond in Florida in ways that probably hurt him in the general election. So it's all kind of connected. So that's different, but it also means that, you turn, especially here, you turn on your television, and I guess I'd ask each of you to kind of keep score if you can stand to. Watch till the end of the ad when you see the fine print and see if it's from an actual candidate or from an outside group. And if you're seeing ads now, as they are in North Carolina, they're from outside groups. And that is all part of Citizens United. But I really think they're only just now figuring out how to do it. I mean, that was their first run through, and it's only going to get more sophisticated. And for the candidates, if you're a candidate who's targeted by outside groups, any outside group from any stripe under Citizens United, it just means that's kind of that much more money you have to raise to push back, and it becomes that much more of a money game. Those are just some quick thoughts anyway. Yeah.
Another question, as we close in on the end of our evening here with Don Gagne. Yes, sir. Your name is?
My name is Eric. Thanks, Don, for coming. We've enjoyed you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask, throughout my lifetime, and I'm in my mid-30s, I've seen news change so much now to where I can get online, I can even go on TV and I can get fair and balanced news or other kinds of news that are tailored specifically to my interests. So one of my
interest in having you here as a member of the press corps is how those biases and those internal sort of thoughts that you have about your own political perspectives, and not you generally, you sort of in the third person, among the press corps, how your own biases fit into with each other, what you cover, how you cover, when you cover it, if at all.
Mm-hmm. I guess a couple of things. There are obviously more and more news organizations capturing more and more eyes, ears, all that come at it from a point of view. I mean, Fox is clearly a more conservative news outlet. MSNBC is a more liberal news outlet. Not all blogs, but, you know, a good percentage of blogs are either a liberal blog or a Democratic blog or a Republican blog or a conservative blog or a Tea Party blog or whatever. So they're all coming at it from a certain place. And then you have kind of the core of, you know, what is often kind of mocked as the MSM, the mainstream media. And that is where, you know, NPR lives and, you know, the main television network, CBS, ABC, you know. I mean, obviously we all approach our work in different ways and we all have a different style. And, you know, NPR focuses on longer stories and depth, and we don't use the word exclusive all the time, you know. In fact, ever, I think, you know, for one. So we could all be thankful for that. I think NPR's belief, this probably applies to other news organizations as well, I just can't speak for them, is that our job is to be an honest broker and to, you know, see what we can learn, see what facts we can discern, try to get some sense of what it means, and present it to you in hopefully an enlightening way that might make you think about something a different way. I can tell you in my own personal reporting, it's a long discussion, but my general philosophy is it doesn't matter what I think about any story, because you don't want to hear what I think about a story. I have no right to impose kind of my view of this issue or that on you. I mean, that would just be kind of so presumptuous of me to do that. And maybe it's because I've been doing this for so long, that I don't find it hard to kind of step back during the news gathering process. You know, when I'm talking to those people on the street in Selma, North Carolina, or when I'm talking to a politician or whatever, I think it's important to share with you as much as I've learned, but what I might think about any given story, and that's not to say I have an opinion on every given story, I don't, you know, but when I do, it's none of my business to kind of impose that upon you in a story. That would diminish not just that story, because it would be obvious what I'm doing, but it would also diminish my whole body of work, you know, which I'm pretty proud of over the years. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons I've been able to do it so long. But it is a very different world out there. And just as significant as the fact that there are more news organizations capturing a larger audience where those news organizations do have a point of view, you also, I think, have people who are doing that kind of self-selecting thing where they're deciding only to watch the channel that they agree with and reinforces what they only believe, and only go to the blogs that reinforce what they believe. And that troubles me a little bit. I mean, we want to present information to people that makes them think and might even challenge what they believe sometimes, if that's what we've learned. And we want people to process things that way. But I think we do have a lot of people who are, you know, kind of going to the echo chamber where they go there to hear what they want to hear, and they hear what they want to hear, so it reinforces what they believe. And then I don't know that that's a good thing if people are only getting their news from places that reinforce their beliefs.
Should we take one more question from the audience? Is there one more out there before we wrap up? I think you've been waiting, ma'am. Thank you for waiting.
I hope it's a rag-brag question.
Oh, it is, absolutely, because you can tell by looking at me and my age that I go on rag-brag every year. No.
What's the best power bar, if you're at it?
Kashi. Okay. I wonder if you have an opinion on I have this feeling that the reason why Barack Obama has not been able to accomplish much of any of his agenda goes back to Mitch McConnell's statement at the very beginning that our chief priority is to make sure he doesn't get elected, reelected in a second term. And a little bit of the news from the Fair Balance statement station that distorts most of the news. But also, I also wonder if some of that isn't from some of the southern states' latent, subtle racism.
Well, there's a question to go out on.
I'm going to sit back and watch you answer it, Don.
I don't think I'm going to address the racism question because you have to go into people's hearts, and I'm not prepared to do that. I mean, certainly we all know there is still racism. I mean, it's not over, but I think I'm just going to. I don't think I can answer that portion of the question. I mean, I do think Mitch McConnell's remark was telling. Now, and significant in that he said it. I mean, I can tell you there were a lot of Democrats who wanted nothing more than to make George W. Bush a one-term
right.
president.
He didn't say that.
You know, but they didn't say it. And Democrats did work with him on more things than I think the Republicans have worked with on President Obama. But it was a political decision. And it was a political decision on the part of Republicans. And absolutely it made it harder for the president to do, you know, what he had hoped to do, to govern in the way he described in that campaign, you know. Whether or not that would have happened anyway, you know, we can't say because that's it's a what if situation. George W. Bush talked about changing the tone in Washington, and you know, after his reelection and as he approached the end of his time, he said that was his biggest disappointment that he wasn't able to do that. Yes, go ahead.
We haven't you covered George W. Bush, his presidency for 8 years. We've given scant attention to that. In closing, do you have a favorite George W. Bush story from your time covering the White House while he was there?
It was a pretty powerful time. I mean, with the 9/11 attacks and, you know, Afghanistan and the Iraq War. So, I mean, favorite is a odd word to use.
Most memorable moment that you can think of, a day that stands out.
I mean, there are a couple of days. I mean, there was obviously, you know, the day the day after the bullhorn moment on the hill, on the hill of rubble, at Ground Zero. I mean, that moment was obviously a very kind of powerful moment, and that wound was just so raw, and we were still kind of in shock at that time. But the next day at the National Cathedral, he delivered a speech that was a very powerful speech. And you saw a president kind of reaching out to the country and kind of helping a country deal with this moment. And I'm reading Peter Baker's new book, Days of Fire, now, which is about Bush and Cheney in the White House. And he talks about that as being kind of one of those moments where President Bush was kind of up to the moment at a very difficult time. But then you kind of fast forward, you know, 6 years from then, we're in the Rose Garden, and it's the day after the 2006 midterm elections. And Bush comes out and says, "We took a thumping," or something like that. And he also, I think, fired Donald Rumsfeld that day. So you kind of saw kind of two moments, both of which grew out of this these cataclysmic events of 9/11. And I mean, I don't know that I've thought of the question the way you asked it before, but just as I sit here now, those are two moments, both kind of rooted in the same moment, you know, where voters kind of rejected so much of what he had done in the previous 6 years in the war on terror, but also that moment right afterward where he clearly, you know, said what needed to be said for the country. So,
and finally, we're not going to let you escape a crystal ball question. At least I'm not. The most likely presidential matchup in 2016, according to Don Gagne.
Most likely
presidential matchup. The nominees from each party will be, based on what you know now.
I don't know that I can pick a Republican. And I think there's so much that can happen between now and then.
Can you pick a wing of the Republican Party where that nominee will be from?
If you pin me down and force me to answer, I think I might say that a governor might have a better track.
From a blue state.
I don't know. I don't know. Then as soon as I start looking at individual governors who might run, you know, it's a gauntlet they have to run. And 3 years out is just, you know. So on the Democratic side, it certainly seems if Secretary Clinton decides to run, she's got, you know, the best path to the nomination. She's not the same person she was, or the same candidate she was, I should say. I can't say she's not the same person. But she's not the same candidate she was when she took on Barack Obama. Now, you may recall that she was the one who was supposed to win then, too, and it didn't work out that way. So a lot can happen, and there are a lot of questions there. Does the country want another Clinton? Is that kind of like an old school pick when the country's ready for a generational shift, you know? But so I won't even predict that she will win the nomination. But, you know, then on the Republican side, there's Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Paul Ryan and Scott Walker. And Mike Huckabee says he's interested, perhaps, maybe, sort of, kind of, again. And so it goes. So it's early, and that's part of what the Iowa caucuses are for. So,
Don Gagne, this has been wonderful. I want to remind our audience that Politics in a Pint is part of Iowa Public Radio's Insight series made possible, and these are important people that help make this event possible. Dr. Richard Deming, Drake University, Isles Funeral Homes, Douglas and Deborah West, and Bob and Kay Riley. Our thanks to Brittley Martin and the entire membership team for this wonderful live event. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance from John Pemble. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Don Gagne, you can come back anytime as an honorary citizen.
Thanks.
Talk politics.
I'll be
eat
back.
Pie. Don Gagne, thank you very much.